Okay. Good morning, Professor Kardar. Thank you very much for joining us. As we've discussed ahead of this interview, the theme of these discussions is on the history of spin glasses and replica symmetry breaking in physics, which we roughly bound from 1975 to 1995. But before we dive into that subject, we have a few questions on background that we'd like to ask you. That bleed around these dates, obviously. So first of all, can you tell us a bit more about your family and your studies before starting university? And in particular, how do you get interested in science in a general sense?
Well, I was born in Iran and continued through high school in Iran. I guess I was always interested in mathematics and science, and I had all intentions to continue studying in Iran for university, but kind of unbeknownst to me, my father had gotten me an application to go to UK for my university. And I came to where I'm currently, Cambridge University, and I got a degree in natural sciences. And then for a PhD, went to MIT starting in 1979.
So what drew you to so you studied natural sciences with a focus on physics, I guess, at Cambridge. What drew you to this particular subfield rather than mathematics or other sciences, for instance?
I guess if you are coming from a developing country such as Iran, the focus would be to go for something that is high earning position. So it is something like engineering. And if you are inclined towards mathematics, science is a good medium in between to placate the family and yet allow you to continue with things that are more mathematical and theoretical. Cambridge, at that time, I don't know whether it is also currently, did not have a specific degree in physics or chemistry. It was all natural sciences. And so I did indeed focus on physics, but along the way, I took classes in chemistry, material science, and such things also.
So what drew you to pursue graduate studies at MIT then, and in particular to work with Nihat Birkar on disordered materials?
Actually, I mean, when I am involved with graduate applications these days, I'm kind of surprised that I did get to MIT in the first place. Because the kind of applicants that we get have already very extensive research in some particular area and are kind of focused in continuing in that area. Somehow coming from Cambridge University, I had not done any specific research. I was certainly good at various topics that I had studied, and I had excellent grades in the exams and entrance exams, etc. But again, not knowing anything, not having done research in any particular direction, I guess my go-to things to study were general relativity or something very theoretical in high energy physics. And I had taken a risk in coming to MIT because actually I didn't have any funding support from MIT. They just gave me admission without support. And my family said, well, why don't you take a risk? So when I arrived at MIT without support, I sort of looked around for anybody who would give me some kind of financial support. And in some sense, it is by accident that I landed in statistical physics because also the same year that I started as a graduate student, Nihat Birkar was hired as a faculty member. And so he was looking for students and had support. And he said, he offered me a RA position. And I said, yes. And I'm very happy that that accident occurred and I did not end up pursuing general relativity or something else. But I can say that it was completely accidental that I ended up this particular route. There was no underlying plan for that.
Can you give us a general feel of what was the statistical physics community around MIT, Harvard, or Cambridge more generally at that time? Were there group meetings or larger organizations, or were you just working solely with Professor Berker?
I guess Professor Berker was to some extent hired at MIT in order to revive statistical mechanics there. Prior to him, Gene Stanley was at MIT, but he had left for several years earlier. And while MIT at that time was strong in various areas, statistical physics was not one of them. But then Nihat was very active. I will refer to Professor Berker as Nihat if you don't. So he, one of the first things that he did was he arranged for Amnon Aharoni to come to MIT. And Amnon was interacting a lot with Bob Virginaux, who was doing the experiments on two-dimensional materials. Litzler was doing experiments on liquid crystals, so the experimental component was certainly strong, and gradually the theory with bringing in visitors such as Amnon Aharoni became stronger and stronger. And I think the first year that I was at MIT, Amnon Aharoni gave a set of lectures on critical phenomena, and I remember that several people from Harvard and other places were also attending, and so gradually that community grew. And later on, Henri Orland came as another visitor, and that was also an additional external person. So I would say that through the efforts of Nihat Berker, gradually the statistical physics theory at MIT became stronger and stronger.
So, as you were just mentioning, Henri Orland was a visitor while you were there. And from what we understand, you actually taught a class on disordered systems, which you took during your graduate years. And if we're not mistaken, that might have been your first exposure to spin glasses and replica symmetry breaking. Is that the case? And if yes, can you tell us a bit more about this course?
Actually, I would say that Henri Orland gave two courses at MIT that were very influential for me. The first one was a course that he presented jointly with John Negley on quantum many-body systems. They later wrote a very nice textbook that was based on the material that they taught. And maybe I will tell you later why that course was very important to me. The second course was indeed just delivered by Henri Orland and was a very rapid and comprehensive scan through a lot of things that were related to polymers, disordered systems, random field systems, random bond systems, spin glasses. And indeed, he did cover replica symmetry breaking, which was quite new at that time. I should say that one of the reasons that you are presumably doing this historical overview is the role that Giorgio Parisi has played in replica symmetry breaking, etc. And I should say that even before taking Henri Orland's course, I was aware of George's contributions as a graduate student, but not related to replica symmetry breaking, but his work on dimensional reduction in random fields via supersymmetry. And I guess as a second or third year graduate student, we were very intrigued with this, and with two other graduate students who were doing field theory, we studied this paper extensively, and we even wrote a paper among these three students that was an extension of that work. And so my initial exposure to the work of Giorgio was more from the random field perspective rather than the spin class perspective.
Had you come to that paper through the literature, or had you heard of it from colleagues or from conferences? Do you have any recollection of?
Yes. Bob Bergenau at MIT was doing experiments on systems that were mimicking random field Ising models. And so there was always this discussion as to whether the three-dimensional or two-dimensional random field systems were ordered or not. There was the tension between the imprimant argument and the dimensional reduction. And so through the presentations of Bob Bergenau about the experimental work and the contrast of the theoretical possibilities, we had come across this paper of Parisian Serlos.
I see. And you mentioned that quantum many-body course that was very influential to you. Would you mind elaborating why that was?
Okay, so I guess in your original email to me, you said that you are exploring the concept of replica symmetry breaking. And my response was that I haven't really used replica symmetry breaking, but I have used replicas without symmetry breaking. And the way that I came across that is essentially interfaces and paths in random media and replicating them. And for that, the replicated system becomes equivalent to a quantum mechanical set of particles with interactions. And the reason I knew how to deal with this system was because of the class that I had taken with Henri and Negley, where they had mentioned beta ansatz. And so my connection to beta ansatz that I used for this version of replicated disordered paths came through exposure to the class that Henri and Negley were teaching.
I see. We'll get back to these papers in a moment, but I see the connection now. So after completing your graduate studies, you were a junior fellow at Harvard, at which point you were essentially free to choose your own research problems. What generally drove your selection of research directions at that point in your career?
There is actually a continuity between what I was doing as a graduate student and later at Harvard as a junior fellow. Again, the experimental work of Bob Bergenau was relevant because they had looked at the system of krypton absorbed on graphite. And essentially what happens is that graphite presents three possible sublattices for the krypton atoms that they have to select one of the three because of their size. They can't sit next to each other on hexagons that are in sublattice, let's call it A and B. And so they have to select one of the three sublattices, A, B, and C. And so this is a three-state symmetry breaking in the Potts universality class. Now, as you increase the pressure of krypton and more krypton wants to get absorbed on the surface, the way that it does so is that it condenses into domain walls between domains that are in, say, A, B, or C, and then additional material can accumulate in the domain wall between A and B, say. And so a very important aspect of thinking about this commensurate incommensurate transition was the statistics of these domain walls that form between these. So already for my undergraduate, for my graduate work, for my PhD, I had studied a lot commensurate incommensurate transitions and the role of these domain walls. And when I was at Harvard, then given that I had also looked at some disorder system, it was natural to think about what happens to these domain walls when they are disordered. So the underlying system is disordered. So it's sort of a natural switch to go from commensurate incommensurate transitions in the absence of disorder to the presence of disorder. And again, these were one-dimensional defects. And the other thing that I worked on at Harvard was two-dimensional manifolds, random surfaces, etc. And so this is kind of a theme that was with me from PhD days, to think about statistics of lines, surfaces, and then it became dynamics of surfaces and things like that.
In those two works, actually, you use the replica method, as we were just mentioning, and that led to two PRLs in 1985. And right. And in one of these, you mentioned that since the n goes to zero, so the replica limit going to zero, may introduce some complications, it is worthwhile to complement the theoretical results with numerical simulations. You did not, however, elaborate or cite anything about these complications. I presume you were aware of the replica symmetry breaking challenge at that point, was it just so well known that it didn't need a citation, or the other aspect of this question is, did you ever consider computing the stability of the replica symmetric solution a la Thouless and de Almeida, which would have been another approach to validate?
Actually, the concern that I had and the conflict that I had with the scientific community was less regarding the domain of replica symmetry breaking, but the interpretation of even the replica symmetric solution. So if you just look at the case of a single interface in the random environment and you replicate it, the corresponding replicated free energy has a term that is linear in n and a term that is n cubed. Okay, and so if you sort of focus on the n goes to zero limit, from the linear term, you can read off what the quenched average free energy is. But for the case of fluctuations, I wanted to rely on the absence of an n squared term and the presence of an n cubed term to deduce a 1 to the third type of fluctuation for the exponent. Now, immediately anybody who was familiar with the various aspects of probability theory, et cetera, would tell you that this in the large n limits, it just does not make sense to have something like an n cubed behavior. And so there was a lot of resistance to that particular interpretation. So I think I'm not quite sure of something that I wrote many years ago, but if I were to guess what was behind that statement, was not so much the issue of replica symmetry breaking, but just the ability to deduce something from the moments of a distribution.
I see. I mean, a couple of years later, you did work on the beta lattice, or you had a replicated beta ansatz studies of a two-dimensional interfaces with quench random impurities, as we were just you mentioned earlier. And in that work, you were much more careful or at bringing up the spin glass literature. So I was curious if that anything had changed in between those two moments, or just the idiosyncrasies of writing a paper.
Yeah, I just don't remember. Sorry.
So at about the same time as you wrote that paper on the replicated beta ansatz, David Thewlis and collaborators at Cornell, in particular Jim Cetna and Jennifer Chase, who had been at Harvard at the time you were a junior fellow, were also working on replicated calculations on the beta lattice, in the context of spin glasses then. But were you following their work? Were you aware? Was there any general awareness of people using these techniques in that community at the time?
I certainly remember Jennifer and Lincoln Chase at Harvard, but again, my recollection is that with John Imbri, who was also at Harvard at that time, the interest that they seem to be having was more in the question of random field systems and also approaching things from a kind of purely rigorous mathematical aspects rather than replica theories. So that part of their work at Harvard, I was certainly not aware of.
No, they did the work at Cornell, but you might have met
Okay.
them at that. Okay,
Yeah.
so if you had not kept in touch, that situates it.
I think that there was that group at Harvard where John Imbri certainly made a lot of progress on the random field problem and all of that. He was somewhat interested in the random bond problem, but not that much.
I see. In 1986, in between those two works, you collaborated with Yicheng Zhang and Giorgio Parisi on the
Right.
dynamics of growing interfaces. Can you tell us a bit more how that work came about? And in particular, did you discuss with Parisi about replica symmetry breaking at that time?
Okay, so as a junior fellow at Harvard, I was pretty much independent in what I could do. But summers were particularly empty of stimulation in the Cambridge area. There wasn't, most people would have left. There was an opportunity to spend summers at Brookhaven Lab. Per Bach had was then so head of theory there, and he had provided the opportunity to go and visit Brookhaven, and I spent two or three summers there. And I think in one of these summers was when Yicheng Zhang had just been hired at Brookhaven as a postdoc, coming fresh out of his PhD with Giorgio Parisi. And so, again, one of the things that was nice about Brookhaven was that there wasn't much to do except to sit around and talk about science and all kinds of things. And he had interesting, Zhang had interesting things to say. And among the various discussions was a project that Giorgio had suggested to him to look at an equation that described interfaces, and we were not even quite sure what aspect of interfaces it was describing. So that was around, and then I don't think immediately, but after I went back to Harvard, I at some point realized that what Zhang had described to me as the suggestion by Giorgio was very related to these problems of interfaces that I was looking at. And so once that connection was apparent, Zhang and I sort of continued to work and figure out exactly what is going on, what the meaning of the equation was, etc. And then we constructed this paper. I think it was Zhang who was more in touch with Giorgio Parisi. I did not interact with him directly. And it is somewhat interesting that there is this paper that establishes a connection between me, Zhang, and Giorgio Parisi, but I did not, I don't think I talked to Giorgio in person until 10, 15 years later.
I see, I see. Once you became faculty at MIT, you kept on using the replica method to study, in particular, paths in disordered system. And Henri Orland was doing similar work at that same time as well. So had you kept in touch with him through the after the course, or were you at all in touch with
him? Oh, yes,
parents?
Yes, certainly. I mean, Henri was certainly a great influence, both in terms of the classes that he taught and the opportunity to have somebody else interested in statistical physics. And I certainly recall that both of us met many times at the Kavli Institute of Theoretical Physics, whether it was KITP or before that in IDP. And we wrote papers also. I guess his approach was more to disordered systems, was through variational approximations. And we did have at least one paper that was related to an interface that we looked at with the variational method.
So, but did you ever travel to Paris and visit the in those years and visit the groups working in statistical physics there, or that was
okay? So I should say that I did not travel very much, and the reason for that was because, again, I'm originally from Iran, and I was carrying a passport from Iran, which limited travel to a large extent. So I had to be very careful when I wanted to make the investment of applying for visas several months ahead of time to be able to visit some particular place or other. So as I mentioned, it took me maybe, I don't know. So after a while, I was permanent residence. I had a green card, but my passport was still Iranian, and so that limited where I could. It was only around 2000 that I became a full U.S. citizen, and then I started traveling more frequently.
I see. I see. So in the early 90s, you did work on a spin glass model, the plus or minus J in 2D. What drove you to be interested in this model? It's a bit uncharacteristic in compared to the other work you'd been doing, seemingly at least.
Yes. So I guess one of the things that I was drawn to the problem of the directed polymer was that it was something that was possible to calculate realizations of it numerically in polynomial time. And so you were kind of sure, or well, you were in better, you were more certain of what was coming out of the numerics, because you could sort of get results that were almost exact in polynomial time. And then I guess teaching classes that were related to statistical physics and teaching in particular on Salier solutions, etc. It was clear to me that one could also do the 2D Ising model, the partition function, etc., in polynomial time. One thing that I did not fully appreciate is that summing over all possible realizations was still a very difficult task to do. Indeed, and I had an excellent graduate student, Lauren Saul, who was able to write nice integer implementation of this argument and calculate partition functions, etc., in polynomial time. So that was really the underlying reason to sort of more bring this algorithm to the attention of the community. I think in principle we could have done more with it, but we, after my student went on to other things, I did not follow up on that, but I understand that other people have, and which is positive thing that we wanted to germinate.
So in that work, you acknowledge conversations with David Hughes and Danielle Fisher. So were you following this Spinglass conversation throughout these years, or in what ways were you in touch with them in that otherwise?
I was certainly through all of the meetings, and I guess for statistical physicists in the 80s and 90s, I think we should all acknowledge the importance of Joel Lebovitz statistical physics meetings that would take place twice a year. And a lot of these debates about spin glass, replica symmetry breaking, the perspective of Hughes and Fisher were constantly at the forefront of these meetings. And so if there was anything exciting and important in statistical physics, they were present at Joel Lebovitz's meeting. And I think I and my students certainly owe a lot to his continuing these meetings now in, I don't know, their fifth or sixth decade.
So you mentioned that others have followed up on that work, but do you remember what was the initial reception to your results? How was it met?
I would say that, again, what I see as the important aspect of what we did was to introduce a technique and a method. I was myself not particularly satisfied with the results that we got about what we could say from that method about the nature of the two-dimensional spin glass and the exponents and the way that the heat capacity and other things became singular as you approach zero temperature. So I think it was accepted as a method and something to follow up, but there was no definitive results in my perspective that emerged from that. And I think that was the perspective of the community too.
So you mentioned that that at the time, a lot of the statistical physics community would center on Rutgers, or would at least be meeting at Rutgers. Was there, over the 15 years or 15, 20 years that had elapsed since your arrival in Cambridge, had there been major changes in the statistical physics community in Cambridge proper?
There is constantly changes, and the focus of the community is being modified as time goes on. And different people join in and go out. And this is the perspective that when I started, the statistical physics community was much closer to material science and phase diagrams and such things. And people in metallurgy and material science would come to meetings and interact with us. Then at later times, it became interest in disordered systems, granular materials, and then soft matter, biological physics, starting with things that are related to proteins, and now having gone to the condensates, etc. So it's a constantly evolving community, and it kind of branches. And so some people that you interact a lot at some point move out of your sphere. Just as an example, say Barabasi and Stanley, who were kind of working on interface growth problems, and Barabasi has a paper, has a book on that with Stanley. Then later on, he has moved on to networks and network science. And it's a totally different community that is looking at these complex systems that maybe has less interaction with, say, the physics of living system community that we have at MIT, that is interested in active matter, in biological systems, in non-reciprocal interactions, etc. So somehow, for example, in that particular example, abstraction of networks and reality of biological systems have completely fracture to communities that don't necessarily talk to each other. And so the what I see is statistical physics is something that has been continuously growing and evolving. One of the things, however, that I'm a little bit worried about is that this is true of MIT, and I think many other places, is that when we are looking to hiring, we don't say we want to hire somebody in statistical physics. It has to be something that is either biological physics or some other thing that uses statistical physics as a tool. Whereas when we are examining graduate students, our PhD requirements are four courses. There's quantum mechanics, electrodynamics, classical mechanics, and statistical mechanics. So it's supposed to be at least one of four pillars of physics, yet we are not hiring necessarily people who are whose primary expertise is statistical physics.
This actually naturally brings us to the next question, which is, did you ever teach? So we know you teach statistical physics. Did you ever teach spinning glasses or replica symmetry breaking at MIT or elsewhere? And if yes, can you detail, please?
Actually, no, I have not. I've no, so I mean, I do teach things that are related to critical phenomena, etc. And it is possible that at the end of my classes, I devote two or three lectures to either disordered systems or, but it would be a very kind of rapid survey rather than something that is focused on giving the students the proper tools to deal with that.
You did teach a bit about spin glasses at the Les Ursules School in 1994. Is that correct? And is that where then you first lectured on the replica method?
I think it was, again, more on, yes. Okay, now I remember. It was indeed on disordered systems with focus on these directed paths. I don't know how much further it went, but probably that is... those notes were the foundation of what appears as the final chapter of my book on statistical theory of fields. So that's, yes. So that again is the context that I mentioned, that when I teach the class at MIT, that part which grew out of the lectures from the Rezush would be condensed to one or two lectures at the end.
Okay. So it was not part of the MIT lecture ever. That's what I... So
yeah.
we understand that... So there's the pair of graduate textbooks in statistical physics that we were sort of alluding to. But before these were published in 2007, there was a set of lecture notes that circulated broadly. Can you help us understand a bit what led to the genesis of these notes and the books? And in particular, when did you start teaching this material at MIT?
Well, I was hired at MIT in 1986. And from that point onward, on and off, I have been teaching classes in statistical physics. I guess in initial years, Professor Nihat Berker was still around, and he would sometimes alternate teaching these classes, etc. And there are, of course, different perspectives. His classes were more focused on position space renormalization group. But as I was teaching my material, it was kind of common for me to write up notes. And then at some point, I would distribute these notes to the students. And then I guess there was a lot of encouragement from the students. Why don't you make these notes, put them together into a book? And that's the origin of the books. They still admittedly have this character of notes, the lecture notes that have been put together. They're kind of terse. One of the strengths, however, I think that giving these classes every year, I had to develop new problems and problem sets. And so having those problem sets is probably a strength of these books.
In both your the book Statistical Physics of Field and the original Lezouche lecture notes from which the final chapter of that book is taken, you do mention or you talk about the regime of validity of the replica method in its sort of provable sense, but you do not mention replica symmetry breaking itself. Is there any particular reason why the words don't appear or the concepts don't appear at all?
Maybe we should go back to Henri Orland's class, which was quite intimidating, I should say, at the end, because he was putting a lot of things together. And thinking back about how the facility with which he could present this material, my style of lecturing is that I should be able to go in front of the class and do the entire calculation, whatever it is, without resort to notes. So I should be able to keep everything in some logical sense in my mind. And for some, whatever reason, maybe it was just because of lack of trying, I never developed that facility for presenting the replica symmetry breaking calculation from beginning to the end. So that's why I have not presented it in my lectures, and hence it didn't make it into books. But it is really reflection of my weakness in grasping the entire picture in a manner that I would be able to present systematically within one class.
From what we can tell, you've been one of the very few US-based physicists to use a replica method in your work, in the 90s at least. Do you have any insight as to why that might be?
Yeah. Not really. I mean, there is always conflicts between characters of various people and think the way that they are approaching things. And there are trends. I can't really say why people would use one method or the other or avoid using something. It just doesn't make sense in my mind. There is some style of results and calculations that I was attracted to. And so for me, those results, it was interesting to sort of look at moments on distributions and things like that. And to do things that were simple enough that I could also test them on the computer. And that I could do with the replica method and looking at the moment. Somehow, I would say I was probably put off by the controversy regarding spin glasses and the different approaches that people had. And rather than to sort of wade into that controversy and try to take one side or the other, I thought that there were other problems that were interesting enough that I could work on and were close to my interests. To what extent that generalizes to other people in the community, I have no idea.
So we're nearing the end of this interview. So is there anything else you would like to share with us about this era that we may have missed or overlooked?
It was an exciting era, and it is continuing. And I must say that I'm very impressed with all of the new results that are emerging, the work that you guys have done on the glass transition in high dimensions, being able to finally do some things in the glass, the real glass as opposed to spin glass transition. So it's wonderful to see the progress that has been made in this direction. And I don't know whether I'm close enough, maybe I'm close enough to the end of my teaching career, but maybe one of the things I would like to do is to add eventually that chapter on replica symmetry breaking to my books and do the teaching and maybe mention your work.
Well, thank you very much for that. In closing, do you still have notes or papers or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you intend to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
I may have, but I would have to go back and look at some filing cabinets that have not been opened in many years to see if there is something there or not. Yeah.
Well, if you get around to it, I encourage you to consult the MIT libraries before discarding any of it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for this conversation. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you for taking the time.